This is an episode about how executive recruitment works at the highest levels. It's about how headhunters think, how they build a search, how they identify talent, how recruiters assess whether someone is relevant for a role, and how candidates can build better, more strategic relationships with headhunters over time. Today's conversation is with Gerald Miles, a headhunter specializing in the games and entertainment sector and co-founder of Mission One. Now, before you think, I don't work in gaming, so this episode may not be for me, I want you to stay with us, because what Gerald shares today is much bigger than gaming. If you replace the word gaming with mining, education, retail, technology, financial services, health, government, or any other sector, the principles are the same. Gerald is very open about the process behind executive search. He explains how recruiters work with clients, how they map the market, how they use LinkedIn, how referrals matter, and why being visible in the right way matters more than being visible everywhere. We also talk about career positioning. Gerald shares how he moved from a broader tech search into a very specific niche in gaming and why niching down helped him become known in the market. Now, this part of the conversation is really useful for anyone thinking about their own professional positioning, especially if you're in a senior leadership position trying to stand out in a competitive market. We also discuss what happens when candidates come from outside the recruiter's niche. This is something many experienced professionals ask me about, especially when they want to move into an adjacent industry. And Gerald will give you a very honest view of when that works, when it doesn't, and what makes a crossover story more convincing. So if you are actively job searching or quietly considering your next move or simply trying to understand how senior hiring really works, I think you will find this conversation really practical and grounding. And if after listening to this episode, you realize you need help working with recruiters, positioning yourself for senior roles, or planning your job search, you can reach out to me. I'm a career coach. I'm specialized in experienced professionals in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, willing to remain employable and in control of their careers. You can book a one-on-one consultation with me at any time through my website. And if you would like to work with me over your transition period, let's say 3 or 6 months, you can book an introductory meeting with me so that we can discuss the level of support that will be right for you. All the details are available on my website, renatabernardi.com. That's RenataBernardi.com. There's a link to it in the show notes. Now, let's welcome Gerald Miles to the Job Hunting Podcast.
Hi, I'm Renata Bernardi, and this is the Job Hunting Podcast, where I interview experts and professionals and discuss issues that are important for job hunters and those who are working to advance their careers. So make sure that you subscribe and follow, and let's dive right in.
All right, so let's get going. Let's talk about gaming and entertainment. Tell me how you managed to be in that industry.
Yeah, sure. Well, thanks for having me on the podcast as well, Renata. Delighted to be here and to be talking to your listeners.
Thank you.
I'm a headhunter, as you've identified, and I'm also one that works extensively in the world of games and entertainment. Pick that up. So I started doing sort of broader tech. So I was doing CTOs, VP engineering, CPOs, product for a lot of earlier stage, Series B, Series D, venture capital backed, SaaS businesses, consumer tech, things like this. And I was doing that without a huge degree of passion. I'm honest, the longer story there, I was actually trying to become a political advocate. And so I had a job in Parliament writing speeches. And I was that was sort of career plan A. And headhunting was a part-time job to pay the bills. And so I was doing that. And then one day, one of the partners came along and said, I've got a game search in Barcelona. It's mobile gaming. And I said, that sounds really interesting. I'm a big gamer. I've never done a search in computer gaming before, but I used to play a lot of games as a child and as an adult. Took that on, and it was a real baptism of fire in that mobile gaming is a very specific niche. There's a lot of knowledge you need to know what's going on there. And I was working with a CEO who was one of the original mobile games CEO founder. He knew everything there was to know about it. So it was constantly, I'd be trying to research to make sure I was ahead of him saying, this game is terrible, or don't you know about that big scandal? Because there's all this sort of internal knowledge. So I had to come up very quickly a curve around gaming and what it was about. And I had a real affinity with it. And I realized, look, a lot of people don't know this niche. A lot of people think that's for kids. Or, you know, there's a lot of, I think, views people had on computer gaming, particularly this is going back to 10 years almost there. And it was becoming a really explosive growth sector, particularly with the rise of mobile gaming, which is now the largest segment of gaming. It went from nothing to hundreds of billions of dollars as a global industry in a decade. And I picked up that first search, thought this is interesting, got extremely lucky in picking up another search very quickly off the back of that. And again, I wasn't a revenue generator at that time. So I started generating revenue, which is a great way to advance your career if you're, you know, in headhunting. And thought, wow, I could do this. And rather than being, you know, one of a thousand doing SaaS CTOs across the world, I thought, wow, maybe I could be the number one at games, right? That's a realistic thing. It's quite a small number of people specializing in here. And that was also attractive to me to try and be the top in my industry and find a sub niche and be really the number one there. So that's how I started in gaming, and it grew from doing a lot of work in mobile gaming. We then started picking up in Europe, and then we started picking up clients in North America. The co-host of my podcast, Dan Hampton, he's also the co-founder of Mission One. I started working with him at my old company. He's based in North America. So the two of us together start to really own this niche. And then it grew. And then I think we were sort of the guys under the radar doing games. And then at the time, we picked up what was the largest retainer our search firm had ever done. It was $400,000. It was like a really big retainer. And it suddenly got us on the map as like, oh, wow, like games is really interesting. And it sort of as a sector. So, and that role was like a $5 to $10 million compensation role, really big international role there, very exciting. So that it then just grew and grew. And now we have our own company, Mission One. We're across technology around gaming. So it's a little bit just broader than just game making. So it's technology around gaming. It's around content in games. That's PC, console, and mobile games. Mm-hmm. And then this kind of interesting area, and I don't know if you see this in reality as well, but we see more crossover between games and other sectors. So you see companies like a fitness company or language learning company or health company, fashion company, looking at games either to sell into that market or to take talent out because it's got usable techniques, monetization mechanisms, et cetera, to then go and bring into other sectors. So Duolingo is a good example of that, or I'd also look at chess.com. Yeah, there's a lot of these very successful consumer businesses that have gamified one way or another, or gamified is a narrow term, but also looking at other ways there. So I'm based here in the UK. It's a big market in Europe as well for games. My co-founder, Dan, Dan Hampton's based out of Miami. So we're across North America, Europe, and Middle East as well. It's a big area of growth, as you might know. A lot of investment going into mobile games, particularly from Saudi Arabia.
That's amazing. I'm so interested in this. It's something completely foreign to me, which now I regret, because I was born in the 70s, raised in the 80s. I love Halt and Catch Fire. It's one of my favorite TV series. I don't know if you're familiar with Halt and Catch Fire, but it's all about the beginning of the gaming industry in California and computers and finally internet. It goes on for a few seasons. And I was there. I lived in Silicon Valley. My father worked in tech, and I never got into games. It's quite bizarre. But what I love about your story is something that I wish a lot of my clients who are looking for work and looking for to becoming thought leaders and experts in their fields, SMEs, to find a niche that gives them purpose, to find a niche that marries revenue with something that you love, you enjoy, you can talk confidently about. So that's really lovely. What I love to hear more from you is for people that are outside of this headhunting world, especially outside of gaming, how does it work behind the scenes? How do you find your people? Why, how do you find the right candidates for your clients?
It's a great question, Renata, and obviously one we get asked a lot. Probably the first question I always get asked whenever I explain something I've ahead of this year, but how do you find the people? And it's process, right? I'm a big believer that most things that are sound complex or strange are just unusual, right? Or like, you know, they're just a process that you sort of break down into smaller parts, and there's not a magic piece to it. I think headhunting is interesting in that it involves many different skills. So I think everyone is sort of probably quite good at bits of headhunting. I mean, everyone is quite good at some bit of headhunting, and probably everyone is quite bad at other bits. And I suppose a very few individuals get to be good at all pieces through work or talent. So it starts out with, I think, clear understanding of what you're looking for, right? Like clearly articulating with the client and understanding the market they're going after. And that's why I like a specialism as well, because you start up to speed. Whereas if you're doing, the broader you are, the more you're, oh, interesting. And is this a good company? Is that a good company? You know, you're trying to learn that story around, you know, if you're doing something really niche to the client up. So it's thinking quite deeply about what are you looking for? Where are the talent pools that these candidates are going to come from? So is it going to be other large listed companies? That might be a factor. It might be higher growth companies. It might be people who have done a turnaround recently, right? So you're trying to narrow it down to, okay, where are the likely individuals coming from? And there might be creative ideas as well. You might say, well, this is kind of analogous to that. So to get, you know, to a games example, a big thing in mobile games is free to play games. Now, some PC console games are also free to play. They're sort of games as a service. So you might say, well, actually, maybe someone could cross over. They often don't, actually. But maybe at the more mid-core, and I might be going to tell you, mid-core, hardcore end of gaming, you might find a more crossover area there. So you start to think creatively. So once you've got your target list of where you're looking for, you then start to think, okay, about the levels of the kind of people that could be right. And then you usually, as a headhunter, you've got a strong network and a strong understanding. So you're going straight away to, who do I know already who's either a good fit for this role or has employed people who are good fits for this role? Like, whose advice do I trust? So that's the sourcing part of the search that we go into. So we do a lot of sourcing, a lot of, you know, named referrals of people, understanding where the best talent pools lie. And then we're also backing that up with a lot of desk-based research. So you're going through LinkedIn, you're title searching on LinkedIn, and, you know, really what you're trying to do is build up. I like to think, I was explained to me an old boss, he says you're trying to cut the cake in as many ways as possible. So sourcing, referencing, desk-based research to try and find the broadest number of candidates who could be excellent fits for that. And then you're handing them over to the client, and there's a lot of work there in actually converting those candidates. But I'll pause there. That's some of what we call the identification piece, which is a combination of intelligence-based research around talking to people and desk-based research that complements each other.
Okay. I'm assuming that a lot of the great candidates come recommended. It's such an interesting niche. How much does LinkedIn plays into your sourcing?
Yeah, so it's integral to helping build out that funnel. As I said, it really is the two sort of horses pulling the cart, really, of, as I said, the human-based intel that you're getting, and then desk-based research. And that could be, it's not just LinkedIn, though. I think it's LinkedIn is clearly an important part of that, you to help find titles. In some ways, it's also to help you find the shape of a company. So it's not just the individual, but you're getting a sense of leveling, a sense of, if you're talking to a candidate, it's really helpful to know, go, oh, I saw somebody who's also an SVP here, who's got a quite similar title. What do you do between them, right? And they suddenly go, oh yeah, well, they cover North America and I do Europe. So they give you this, it helps you unlock and understand a candidate's profile better there. And then also, again, sometimes looking at websites, looking at annual reports, etc., can also help you understand, okay, how do they structure these divisions? Who's really the GM, general manager, who's in charge of that unit? And who do they report into? How does that flow? Were they in charge when they went through a particularly good patch or a particularly bad patch, right? And you can ask them about that. So I'd say LinkedIn is probably our, of all the tools we have, it's number one, you know, in terms of importance there, but it's also in combination, or it's not sort of LinkedIn alone in how you're going about your searching.
Okay. With the roles that you are assigned to do, do they get advertised? Because many of my listeners feel like these roles are not being advertised. Is that right?
Correct. Most of these roles are not advertised, or no, we don't work on any advertised roles. And the reason for that, there's a couple of reasons for that, but I think the main one is the candidates you're often trying to get. So we work on senior level roles, and I think it is different at anything below sort of director level. So anything sort of manager, senior manager below lead, individual contributors, I think it's a different type of market. But for us, it's about identifying who are the top people. They're probably very well settled in their role. They're probably not looking. And also, so you'll want to make them feel so special. You want to make them feel like this is the inside track, right? These are the jobs, as you said. These jobs not being advertised, right? These are some of the most exciting, best paid, biggest opportunity roles in their sector. Mm-hmm. So a number of reasons we want to advertise. One is you don't want the volume of just everyone applying, right? We used to, at our old company, we had a system where you could upload, it was board roles, it was a different product, and people could upload or apply for roles they saw was interesting. And you used to get people from everywhere. Like a job would say, it needs to be in Germany, and somebody in Nigeria or Singapore would apply. And you'd say, well, you have to review it. And yeah, it takes up a lot of human time to say politely, but you didn't even read the brief. You just thought that sounds a good job. So it can take a lot of resources. And that means we might miss the most relevant profile. You're then creating the haystack to find the needle, right? Rather than just going straight in to look. So, and also the company hiring might not want it to be public often, right? You might mm-hmm. want to let anyone know this is, yeah, some of our roles are confidential. Even the person replacing doesn't know. You know, you can't be putting it out there, or there's, you know, you're deliberately keeping under the radar because you're sitting on a gold mine. You don't want to tell everyone about it, right? Because you want to mine that gold yourself before you're telling everyone too widely. So no, we don't advertise in there. People are right. These roles are locked behind. And we on our podcast, actually, on the Executive Edge podcast that we have, we actually talk a lot about this, of like, how do you position your career to access those roles, right? How do you get on the radar of those roles that are not easily accessible?
Well, that was my next question to you. So if you have a senior executive that wants to be on your radar for these opportunities, what is the best way for them to reach out to you?
Yeah. So a number of things. I mean, there's the lens of like, how do I get hold my head up. So that's a sort of as simple as sending them a message and hoping that, you know, their inbox isn't too rammed that day and being a bit persistent. So that's sort of the easy connecting. But I think the bit behind that is understanding, you know, who are the relevant headhunters for you to know. Because again, sometimes I get emails from people saying like, hey, I'm a CFO at a fintech business. And I'm like, that's great, but that's not really my specialism, you know. And you sort of politely again sort of say, I don't think I'm the best person to help you. And you presume maybe they've emailed a list of people. But there are going to be headhunters that are hyper relevant to you as an executive and really know how to help you. So if you're in games and support a consumer around that, then I'm a great headhunter to know, right? We'll have a relevant interest in if you've got a background in those areas. If you're doing industrials, I'm not the best headhunter to know. There are other people, right? So it sounds a basic point, but I see execs going wrong on that, right? Or again, it's seen as, maybe we're seen as a bit generic. Understand the headhunter. I could go deeper on that. Obviously, certain, you know, big firms, if you want to do big listed corporate roles, again, you probably want to engage with a very specialized headhunter on those kind of roles, or the bigger, what we call Shrek firms, that these larger, these multinational companies, again, they might be doing a lot of the listed work. If you want to go work for a venture capital biz-backed business, right, again, there'll be niche areas there, and geography is another area. So I think that's one of the bit is just researching, you know, in your industry, and it'd probably be only 4 or 5 people probably across your region. So if you're in Europe doing, again, SaaS, CTO, something like that, there's probably maybe a bit more, 5 to 10 top people at different firms. And it might be, you know, it might be at that lower end that you need to be on the radar of. You don't need 20, 30 contacts. Because they'll be taking a lot of that market share.
Jared, but if it's an adjacent industry, for example, I'm thinking of a specific client of mine. He is a CPO, chief product officer for a SaaS company with experience working with large and mid-sized SaaS organizations. Is that close enough to what you do that you would be interested in talking to him or no?
It would depend. Probably not, to be honest. Again, it would depend a little bit on the nuance of, okay, well, is there applications for what they're doing? So again, some areas have a lot of overlap, right? Or we might pick up a SaaS client that's mainly serving games but wants to look broader. But it's probably not is the answer. And that's in the, again, it's in the nuance of where's the overlap, right? Are there a lot of clients that overlap? Are there a lot of similarities of the market or the approach to market? You know, the use case, if you're a product officer, you know, this of the type of designing. If you look at someone who's, you know, we were doing a search recently and we're looking at some people from a consumer marketplace mobile app. And we looked at, and just the way they do product is so different from what they were doing in games. It just didn't make sense, even though the high level similarities were there.
Okay. So you've placed executives across, I'm assuming, North America, Europe, you said Middle East as well. What are the patterns that you see in the people who consistently land the roles that they want, regardless of geography or culture? Can you find patterns in your successful candidates?
Yes, I think you can, Renata. So some of the patterns would be they often have a career and a CV trajectory. And again, we talk a lot about this on our podcast. It's like, how do you shape your career narrative, right? To position yourself to really maximize your end goal, right? Like 5-10 years time. How do you think about how do I get to those top C-level jobs even when you're 5-10 years away and you're creating that arc? So I think the best candidates, often they've just got track record of success. So they've just gone to multiple different places for a good amount of time. So they've gone for 3 to 5 years often, and they'll be able to show they were part of some key transformational, key driving element there. It could be growth. That's obviously lovely. It could be, look, actually, in a difficult market, we reduced decline. It could be we managed to stay stable against a declining market. That can be a great story as well, right? But it has to be something where people, you know, we reference people a lot, obviously, as well, where the referencing, the CV, the tenures, they all stack up to say, wow, this person, when they came into an organization, their impact was felt and everyone was aligned around that. And good people want to keep working with them. That's another big part of it. You know, that sort of good people follow them. Hey, I've hired people out of that company before and I know they're good. You know, there's just certain areas within industries where like people come together and they create magic. And if you've done two or three of those, you're proving it wasn't just a one-off fluke. You should be in the right time, right place. It's hard to do that. So again, it's not easy to sort of look, you know, sit down and go like, right, I kind of joined this XY company. But I think, you know, selection of your own companies you go join, right? Because that will affect you, right? I think sometimes people take a job and they regret it. 2 years later, they're out. You know? And unfortunately, for a CV perspective, that is a bit of a, it can be a bit of a drag. It's not fatal at all. You can get over that, but it can be a bit of a drag where it takes a shine off something. I think being really selective about the quality of the people you're working with, the opportunity that's there, the sort of the quality of the other people who are going to be in that organization, you're building that narrative and staying at a good level of time and thinking, okay, what am I going to own or what am I going to really drive here, so that if somebody references me, they can say, wow, this person was really critical. That will keep building your opportunities and keep making you the most desirable candidates in the market.
And if you think about gaming and entertainment in the years ahead, 2026 and beyond, is this an area that is high growth, so that if somebody is thinking about their careers and thinking about pivoting into games and entertainment, is it worthwhile pursuing that? let's say if they're in SaaS or tech or something adjacent and they want to jump into games and entertainment, is that a good investment of their time, or do you think the market is already saturated for the industry?
So right now, games is in a sort of depressed phase of growth.
Okay.
It's post-COVID. So post-COVID, there was a massive boom because everyone was inside and people had money to spend, right? So they were inside gaming, spending on games. So we had this huge accelerated sort of party rush of money into games, right? And everyone and their dog was buying gaming companies. Post-COVID, thankfully, we all got to go outside and do other things apart from play games. And that led to games companies that hired on the premise that they were going to keep growing at X percentage. And even if they were growing, you know, if you're growing at 2%, but you've hired to grow at 15%, right? You've got too many people in the org. So we've seen huge amounts of layoffs in the last sort of 2-3 years, 4 years. Since COVID has 3 years, isn't it? And also a big impact on the quality of games and production pipelines due to work from home policies being shaken out again, people working from home, making games has been harder when people are working at home. That's led to more costs, meant to more losses, things like that. So overall, even though I think the top line of the numbers are growth in the industry, it's really been very low growth and it's been very heavily weighted to a small number of players. And there's been a lot of pain in the market the last 3 years. So it's not a golden time to get into games. Now, having said that, we're very long on the opportunity around gaming because we sort of look at it as play. Play is essential to human experience. Like people enjoy playing and have done since the dawn of time. You see animals doing it, and that's going to maintain, you know, growth. And I know you talked about sports and things like your other podcast, right? Like in other areas, right? We're always going to be playing some sort of game and enjoying ourselves in a community and play and solos. That market will grow. Whether there will be a sort of a big shift, like a big tech shift that will create an explosive opportunity, my guess is yes, but I don't know what that is. So again, going back to mobile games, mobile went from nothing to hundreds of billions. So if you could go back in time and get into mobile gaming in 2010, fantastic. So a lot of people became multi-millionaires or hundreds of billionaires right around that growth period if you were in at that time. And it was kind of funny because at the time it sort of mocked as a pathetic sort of not real games type thing. What's going on here? People aren't going to spend money on mobile gaming. What are you talking about? And then you have Candy Crush and the likes making, you know, billions and billions of dollars. So it's a hard industry to get into at the moment. I would advise you though, I mean, again, I'd do it if your passion is there, I'd say, you know, follow that, find the niche, right? Like find the area that you can create. Now, I think the more interesting area though is at this crossover. So we see companies like a Duolingo, they just acquired a games company based in London, Eat, ban out of Space Ape. Really smart bunch of guys, but that's kind of interesting. You see Duolingo is buying a games company. Netflix also built up a games division, which you might know about. Now that's been a bit of a rocky, I think, road for them, and it's going to be, you know, how much they're going to keep investing in there, I don't know. They're just, you know, we're interested to see. So there's obviously a lot of interest from non-gaming companies about this sector. And I think if you could be at the intersection of that, then there might be something really interesting. And I think, you know, how do you retain users' attention? How do you keep people engaged, right? That's the same thing twice. But, you know, how do you educate people on habits? Those are three things that a lot of companies are interested in, regardless of what you're interested in. Games knows how to do that. So, you know, we had on our podcast a guy called Jonathan Knight. He's the guy who runs New York Times games. So I don't know if you do Wordle, Renata, or do you use any of their
apps?
Popular.
Yeah.
That's become a big revenue stream, right? That's a company of very long history in media, and they always had the puzzle section. But now that's a big chunk of their revenue, and they did that by hiring in somebody from the computer gaming industry, building that up, making a smart acquisition. And they've got, you know, I forget the numbers, but I think hundreds of millions of people use that, right? A lot of people, tens of millions, are doing that daily. And that's kind of cool, right? That's kind of, you know, to re-diversify your industry. And then you think, okay, what can we do on top there? Companies doing it well, companies doing it badly, right? Like, and it's, I think people underestimate what it takes to make a game that's successful and engaging and all the rest. So if you can do it in a serious way, as I said, Duolingo absolutely crushes its competition, to an extraordinary extent because it learned how to gamify things. Its crossover potentials with media. It's a really good crossover that Supercell did, which is a big Helsinki-based games company, and chess.com. They did some crossover rewards where you could get rewards in the game if you're playing on chess.com. That was a huge driver of growth for them. So if you're completely unaware of it and dismissing it, I'd definitely say pay attention, because you know there's billions of gamers out there, and generationally it's only going to get bigger, because you got Rusty, you said you're gonna have a grandchild soon, right? Like at some point that kid will be playing Minecraft, they'll be playing Roblox, or their friends will, or the next generation of that, right? So nowadays kids are coming up used to playing social games as part of their background, and in a way that sort of 40-50 years ago it just didn't happen in the same way generationally. So and it's a much cheaper price point, and you couldn't play online because the internet didn't really exist, right? So nowadays that is a core part of a person growing up experience. And if you can tailor consumer experiences that feel like games, then yeah, you know, that could be a big market. So I'd say stay curious. It's not a golden easy trough of money to just fill yourself on. It's a tough industry, and it's got a lot of nuances, and it's unforgiving, but there's definitely gold to be mined if you can do it in the right way.
Jared, I want to go back to that question that I asked you before about people that want to reach out to you, job candidates that want to reach out to you. I think you were very good at explaining that it needs to be within your niche. I get it. If they are within a niche, so let's go through an example where they are in the games and entertainment sector, they're the right candidates for you. What's the, from your perspective, and I know this varies from headhunter to headhunter, but what's the best way for them to manage their relationship long-term with somebody like you? Because I feel a lot of my clients struggle with that, with maintaining a good, nurturing and maintaining a good relationship with headhunters long-term. What is your advice? What works for you?
So I think there's an element of, I mean, asking them is sometimes, you know, simple advice, saying like, hey, I'd love to stay in contact. What's the best way? And I think people underestimate the value of just saying, what's the answer to this question that I'm wondering about? And that can happen in all sorts of things. So that could be one advice. And you, as you are asking me, right, you are asking me the question. So I would say being really clear about, okay, what the connection is, asking how many roles are you going to have for me? Because if the answer is, yeah, you are relevant to us, but it might be one role every 18, 24 months. That gives you sort of a clue of like, I don't need to check in with this person every 3 months to, you know, or we don't need to have a call every week to you know, this is not efficient use of anyone's time. It's staying on the radar. And if you know, okay, they're going to have one role every 2 years, I'll send them an email every 6 months just saying, hey, just reminding them I'm alive. This is what I'm up to. Let me know if a call makes sense, or if you've got any clients that are in this space. Make it really easy for headhunters. Say like, you know, if there's certain companies are interested, say like, hey, these are the companies interested. Do you work with them? If you do, here's an angle why I think I'd be interested in them. I'd love to get an intro. What do you think? Something like that. If it's, or, you know, a niche or a genre or whatever it is, right? So I think being very specific about what you're looking for, what the kind of client who is going to be interested in their profile, and a reason why that client would be interesting. So I introduced somebody the other day who, he messaged me. They're a former C-level exec from a multi-billion-dollar media company. So not a gamer, but again, that being that entertainment world. And they said to me, hey, I'm advising a lot of private equity on some multi-billion-dollar deals. I think this client, who's a client of ours, might be interested if they're looking at the crossover between music licensing and in-game, you know, use of music. It's an area I'm an expert in. What do you think? And I messaged the CEO of that company, and they messaged saying, like, actually, this isn't something we're doing. Fine. I was able to go back to the person saying, like, raise your profile. If they change their mind, they need you. If they don't. But it was very easy for me to say, like, he's a very credible person with a very credible reason why they're contacting. And I feel good about putting that person on their radar regardless, because they're a top level exec. Doesn't matter, right? Like, just interesting person to know. That's really helpful to me versus, you know, where, you know, to say something that I think people can sometimes go wrong is they try and think, but like, hey, let's push for a regular every 3 months, let's have a call. That can be actually not very useful for time consumption. And then you're in a position of sort of saying, look, actually, let's catch up in the summer or something like that. And, you know, that's sort of, again, you know, when people reject it, but you're just trying to manage their time, really, of saying, look, it's just not a reason. So I think it's being clear about why you want to have that relationship, asking them what's the right sort of cadence for us to keep in touch, because that will vary from person to person as well. Like some people, I imagine, love to do lots of emails, or they love to do WhatsApp or calls, or some people hate that. They're very much like, I'll call you when I need to type thing. So, you know, again, we'll all vary as the how we work. So just getting a good sense of that. And then I think just being, you know, every 6 months, drop them a note saying, hey, without expectation, without an ask of let's have a call, you know, or just like, hey, how are you seeing the market for my kind of profile? Do you think, is it hot or not? You know, make it easy. It's like, and you know, no worries if it's not. You know, at least get a sense of where the timing is on that.
I love
what
that.
Do you think to that, Renata? Like, I'm sure you know. How does that match against your clients' experiences? Do they curse headhunters and say, "Oh, they're all so hard to get on the phone, and like they only want you when they have something hot"? Like, what's the view from the other side? Do you think?
Well, that's a very good. Thank you for bringing it back to me. Usually, when I'm interviewing people, what I love about it, and because I do some episodes with guests and some on my own, what I like is the episodes with guests like you, Jared, to validate the advice that I'm giving when I'm doing my solo episodes. And what you're saying is exactly what I tell my listeners, and mostly and more bespokely my clients to do. So as we have this conversation, there's an episode out for the podcast. It's 320, and it's about cringe as in, oh, I find it so cringe to reach out to a headhunter or to a recruiter. I find it cringe to post on LinkedIn or update my profile. Or people really want to play cool and unbothered, right? So that's usually, especially in this space, I've never worked with the gaming and entertainment. Well, I have a client in entertainment, but not with games. But I find that all my SaaS clients, my techie guys, they don't want to be out there networking, connecting, and whatnot. And when they do, they overdo it. They overcorrect it by asking to have a coffee, by asking to have a meeting, and that's way too much for somebody like you who may not be as interested in that candidate as they are in connecting with you. So I think finding that balance in the reach out, the cold reach, where you introduce yourself and you ask a question that's easy for you to reply, rather than asking for more of their time, is probably the right thing to do.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, Renata. And I think that's a common theme of the, like, is it the extremities of action, right? Either like zero interest. So people say this, just like, you know, I haven't been looking for like 10 years. I have a CV and suddenly they now want to look. We do advise people to sort of say, keep a sort of gardening approach, right? Like a little bit of maintenance. And it doesn't have to be with headhunters. We say, like, think about your network most broadly, right? Who are the people you used to work with who've now gone to interesting companies that you would be like, oh, okay, yeah, I could work with them. Like they've gone to a company and you're curious about that. Checking with them, and that might be a really easy connection for you to make, right? Because you used to work with them, right? Hey, how you doing? Let's go out for a pint, you know, sort of, let's catch up. And I think that's right. And I'd also say, you know, again, don't go overboard with LinkedIn. I think sometimes it's not I'd say if you're comfortable with feeling, you know, I don't think we look at LinkedIn from a header. I've never been sort of, wow, that person posts a lot on LinkedIn, they're a great candidate. That's never been in my mind at all. So I think, but being sort of, having something thoughtful, something really interesting to say is kind of interesting, right? If you've got a really high quality insight of, hey, here's something I actually care about, and authentically, this is kind of really interesting knowledge on my sector. That is something I might read and go, I remember that person. They said something pretty smart about that. And if that comes up, I might think, wow, I want to reach out to them because they seem to know about this area, right? And they might become a candidate through this or that sort of reason. Yeah. So yeah, I think that sounds really solid advice.
Yeah, thank you. I've had good, very good results with clients for the past year and a half, 2 years on long form on LinkedIn. So you going on LinkedIn and writing a thoughtful piece, not a post, but more of an article style content where you showcase that you have expertise and a point of view about your industry, about your area of expertise. And I like that for my clients. It's not as easy as it sounds because they may not have written something like that in a long time. You know, people write a lot of emails and internal memos, but they don't put their thoughts into paper. It's usually when I'm having conversations in a private coaching session and I can see their eyes just light up when they're talking about a topic that they're really passionate about. And I'm like, we should put this into paper because I can see your expertise here and nobody else is seeing it. And your LinkedIn profile by itself is not selling you the way that this conversation that we're having is selling you. So I find that a good article, a good couple of posts on LinkedIn that people like you might be interested in reading, that usually is all you need. You don't have to overdo it on LinkedIn and be there every day writing. There's no need for that.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know your opinion, I think that can turn people off, actually. Like, there can be a sort of a suspicion of, and, you know, since we talk about conferences, I think, you know, you can, sometimes they can be helpful, but you don't, we were going to see you talking about this the other week on our podcast, was saying, like, there's people who always just go to conferences. They say, I never hire this guy. So like at every single conference and, you know, just do all about the self-publicity, right? It's a balance of being somewhere for a purpose and leaving a thoughtful impression with someone, I think is really impactful. If you're just being seen all the time and leave no thoughtful impact, yeah, that's actually degrading your own brand, right? If you think about it as a brand proposition, so I think that's an interesting one.
Yes. I like that. And you're right. I think depending on your level of seniority, where you're at in your career, the industry you work in, that should be what drives your LinkedIn presence and your networking calendar for the year. Jared, as a final note, now what piece of advice would you give job candidates looking for work, working with you or otherwise? What are you seeing in the market there that maybe it's a good opportunity to share?
So it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because I think we're all, because there's so much information all the time. I live in constant, you know, the sort of market force of greed and fear, I think, are being stoked constantly within me. And you read one thing and you think, oh, this is going to be exciting. You read another article saying that's a bubble. You know, you're going to get burned if you go into that. So I think, I mean, at one level, no secrets, obviously, that the AI investment is just so much money is going into that, right? And we're going to see that, you know, feeding through. Now, again, is that a bubble? Will that suddenly fall out or there'll be a lot of pain? I mean, the answer is probably yes, right? Probably there will be a lot of pain, right? Because no industry, you know, you see those explosions of interest, right? Like a lot of those companies don't make it. And that's not to say it's not a real industry. It's just, you know, look at car industries. A lot of them went bankrupt and you have a few small ones taking all the market share. That's just naturally what happens in these industries of growth and opportunity. But I still think that is, yeah, really interesting to watch, yeah, with no secret source at all. I think, oh, it's such a big question, Renata. The honest answer is I don't know. I mean, I sort of struggle with this myself. Of, you know, there's some big things sort of geopolitically that could happen. I mean, what's happening with interest rates? What happens with the war? You know, there's a lot of macro. What are Trump's policies on the economy? I mean, I'd say we're still in an era where the waiting to what happens in America is huge to globally what happens in the economies elsewhere. We're still in Europe in a lot of, I think, sticky waters with reasonable inflation and you know, difficult to get interest rates down, a lot of debt, both nationally and at a personal level. So what does that say? I don't know. I think, you know, technology, this is the broadest advice, which is probably the evergreen advice, is look at, you know, where is the disruption happening? Where's the hot money going to flow into? Because you often have these windows of 2 or 3 years in a new space. And whatever sector you're in, try and think about, okay, what's that next crossover place where suddenly that innovation can be happening? Because that's where it gets really exciting for people to catapult their careers, to make, you know, really life-changing amounts of money in equity or whatever it is, and create a great story of growth. If you are in a company where you can sort of see the writing on the wall, probably don't hang on to be the last person standing, right? If you're in a company, you're thinking, it's going to be Kat's next 2-3 years. I'm probably well placed that they'll keep me on to look after that. I'd probably say, is that what you want though, right? Do you want to be sitting with a brand that's on the decline? If you believe it can be turned around, fantastic, right? That could be a great story. But if you sort of know the direction, but you're saying, well, I'd rather sort of stick it for the 18 months, 24 months of paycheck I get versus finding something new and exciting and, or different, then that might be the better mid to long-term call for your career. And that takes a little bit of courage. And again, don't make a call if it's not, you know, again, if you're worried about the mortgage or whatever, right? Don't go do it, right? Like it's a, what's your risk appetite and being very clear and understanding on that and being prepared to you know, lose it all is what I think you have to take that approach, or if you're comfortable taking that approach and do it. So that would be sort of evergreen advice. But no, I don't have a particular market where I'd say, hey, you've got to get into this. But some themes are, so I could name you a number of themes, but I also might say, well, I don't know when that theme stops. You know, investment from Saudi Arabia, investment from the Middle East, you know, that seems to continue. But could that slow down at some point? Potentially, yes, right? It's affected by oil prices and other things. You know, could, you know, AI, you know, which AI companies are going to do super well? I don't know. Or what's the next big tech innovation? Again, and one theme, Renata, and I appreciate I'm going here, but one theme is obviously, again, is just shorter attention spans, right? The sort of TikTokification of other media platforms. We sort of see that, right? Like the fact that you want that shorter dopamine hit. How do you get the compress that, like the Twitter, X, TikTok, all these things are getting very good at condensing it. Then you see them sometimes going back to larger formats, but we see that sort of effect into other industries. And I think that's kind of interesting. If you can take a longer form format and work out a way of really packaging it in a smaller bite-sized piece that hasn't been done yet, that's really interesting. And we see that with audio, for example. Audio stories are getting shorter, and people are really consuming that in a higher volume, and there's a lot of money, hundreds of millions to make out of that. So that'd be an example, I think, of interesting areas to look at.
Okay, one final question. Do you see the Mission One 2026 results being very similar to Mission One's 2025 results? Are you expecting growth or, you know, changes?
I wish I could tell you. I think the answer is we've grown every year. We've been going for 3 years, and we had our best year this year, which is fantastic.
Good.
So logic would say, you know, we're getting the brand out there. And I mean, that's also a slight question of our ability to build the brand and grow. And I think the more entrenched you get, the more of a reputation you get, it's better. Also, we're very market dependent. The games market is slowly picking up. It's slowly getting better, but it's not revving up. But I think 2026 will be better. So I think it will be. But I'm very conscious that we ride and fall on the market a little bit. You're either comfortable with that in a feast and famine type business, or you look to diversify. We are diversifying across more consumer pieces, particularly my colleague Dan Hampton. He's doing more consumer work in North America. So, you know, there's also an element of trying to broaden that out to make sure you're not quite as up and down on one market. But we're hoping that next year is even better, Rob. But again, it's and the nuances of headhunting, I'd rather this to our listeners, but nuances of headhunting is that you're often, lots of people can like you, but if they're not hiring a CTO or a CPO or a CEO that year, right, they don't need you. So it's not a case of like, are you liked, are you skillful, or do people want to work with you? It's more a case of, do they then have a role? And again, you're not hiring a CEO every year, so that's sort of, you get repeat business, but it's kind of it sort of fluctuates with needs. I find headhunting a very hard business to predict in terms of revenue. The smaller scale you are, so we're a boutique, we're an international boutique, but we're a boutique. So if you've got thousands of people, you can aggregate it out a little bit more. But, you know, our revenue can spike sometimes. Sometimes our fees can be, $200,000-$300,000 on a single placement. So again, whether those go off or not makes a big impact to our revenue, or more sometimes. So, you know, it's sort of, there's a big swings that can push a year to being a bumpy year or not, right? Because the person might not get the job or whatever happens there that means it doesn't come through.
Jared, thank you so much for taking the time to have a conversation with us. I think these conversations really give my audience a lot of insights on how headhunters think, you know, how they work, And this is invaluable information for people that are job seeking out there. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. And I hope it's been useful for your listeners. And good luck with the show. It's really interesting. You've got a really broad range of listeners and views that are coming on here. So thank you so much. And I look forward to hearing perhaps from your listeners as well. If any reach out to me, I'll let you know. And
I'll put the link to your podcast below.
Podcast. It's Mission One, the Executive Edge. And yeah, we hope people come on there to help. That's for two purposes. One is to help people improve their careers and get better jobs. And the second is to help people make better hiring decisions as well. So that's the dual purpose of the podcast.
Excellent. Thanks, Jared.